Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. Meaningless, vain, futile is our life here in this world. And of course, he's right, as we have seen over these past 5 weeks. He's absolutely right. After all, he's a wise man. And wise men know these things. He's gathered up all of his vast wealth of knowledge and experience that he has gained throughout his life. He has gone over all the things that he has learned. He has sought out the teaching of other wise men. And he has come to this great conclusion. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And as we've seen, when we look at this world through the eyes of a man like this, everything is vanity. Everything is futile. Nothing does bring ultimate satisfaction when we see things from this man's perspective. Everything that he says is absolutely right when we see it from his perspective. He hasn't been making things up. He's told it as it is, as he sees it. This is what he has observed, and this is his conclusion. All is vanity. And for these long chapters, that's what he's tried to convince us of. But what does the narrator say? What does this man say who introduced us, first of all, way back in chapter 1, to the preacher, and introduced that theme of this world and our life in it being simply a series of meaningless repetitions that has no ultimate destiny and can bring no ultimate satisfaction? What does the narrator have to say about all this? He's given us this lengthy quotation from the preacher or the teacher. He's allowed us into the heart and mind of this wise man of the world. What's been his purpose? Why has he done this? He was careful about two-thirds of the way through the quotation in chapter 7 and verse 27 to remind us that it was a quotation, just in case we were tempted to think that we were supposed to take all of this at face value. He says there in verse 27, "Here is what I have found," says the preacher. Says the preacher. He's been a little bit concerned that in this long, long quotation, people might forget that it is a quotation. You see, this isn't what the narrator thinks. The narrator doesn't think that this world is vain, empty, futile, meaningless. He doesn't agree with the preacher. But he's used the preacher to make a point. Here's what he thinks of the preacher. In verses 9 and 10, he sums it up. He says, first of all, in verse 9, "Moreover, the preacher was wise. He taught the people knowledge. He pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs." Here's what he says about the preacher. The preacher was wise, first of all. He was a wise man. There's no disputing that as a fact. He may not have the wisdom of God, but he's still a wise man. The people around acknowledge this man to be a wise man. We look at Solomon, a wise man. No one disputes that, surely. He's described as being the wisest man. And yet, despite all of his wisdom, as far as the scriptures are able to show us, Solomon died in his sin under the condemnation of God. He didn't have the wisdom of God, but nevertheless, he was a wise man. Indeed, Paul himself, in his first letter to the Corinthians, that passage that we read earlier, talks about wisdom. And he acknowledges that there's wisdom in the world. He says, where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? He's not saying that there isn't any wise. Because he couldn't say there are no scribes. There were heaps of them in Jerusalem. Were there any disputers? Well, of course there were. But God, he says, has made foolish the wisdom of this world. Paul acknowledges that there is such a thing as wisdom in this world. He doesn't ignore that. He doesn't cast it aside as a fallacy. No, there is wisdom in this world. We look around us today, and there are many wise people today, specialists in their own particular areas. Men who have given their lives to understanding the human body so that they can come up with newer, better forms of treatment for the many diseases that we suffer. Men who have given their lives over to the exploration of space to try and understand our universe. Men who have given their lives to all kinds of different things in this world and have grown to be wise men. They're the people that the universities want to employ as their senior tutors. They're the people that the media rushes to have a specialist voice on a particular subject that they're reporting on. These are wise people, no doubt whatsoever about that. And this preacher of the Ecclesiastes, the narrator says, he was a wise man. He's not questioning that for one moment. Here is a man who had a place in society as a teacher. He still taught the people knowledge. Despite all of his quest for understanding meaning in life and being unable to discover this ultimate answer that he wants to find. He's still a teacher. He still has much that he can share with others. Great advice that he can give to other people concerning life in this world. This is a wise man. He's a teacher. And he has a place in this world. The narrator doesn't dispute that at all. This man, after all, has given his life to trying to understand life and this world. He's pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. And we've seen as we've gone through this, many times he quotes proverbs. Many times he alludes to proverbs in the scriptures, but also to other proverbs well known in the world. This was a man who, in his quest for understanding the meaning of this world and our purpose in it, has sought out the wisest men. He's gathered as much information. He's brought together all the proverbs of the world, the wise sayings of mankind, and he's set them in order. He's gathered them under subject headings, and he's produced an encyclopedia of knowledge. This is a wise man. This is a teacher in Israel. The narrator doesn't dispute that for one moment. But he does have doubts about the value, ultimately, of this man's wisdom and of the knowledge that he's gained despite all his searching out of the proverbs of the world. In verse 10 he says, the preacher sought to find acceptable or delightful words. He sought to find, to write what was upright. He sought out words of truth. In the context of what we've been seeing here, the idea of the preacher who is seeking things, seeking truth, seeking upright words, seeking delightful words, should run all the way through that verse. It shouldn't start off with a preacher seeking and then ending up with the suggestion that he's found those things. He's managed to find and write things that were upright. He's managed to find and write the truth. No, he was seeking that. That was his great aim. He was trying to find the truth. And he wanted to write the truth in the way that would bring delight to people. Delightful words. Words that would be very acceptable to us because they would cheer and encourage us. Has he succeeded? Oh no! He's depressed us. He's made us miserable. Because he hasn't found the answer. He sought to find it, but he never did find it. So while the narrator acknowledges this is a man who's wise, everyone acknowledges he's wise, he's a teacher, people employ him in their universities to speak and to teach all from this vast knowledge that he's accumulated. But he's not achieved his goal. He wanted to delight us with fine words, with fine meanings. But he's only depressed us. He had good intentions of writing what was upright, of setting down the truth. But he hasn't found it. And he hasn't therefore been able to do it. And rather than delighting us, he's depressed us. Here then is the wise man of the world. And then the narrator goes on to give a warning. He's given his assessment of the preacher, and now he gives a warning regarding the preacher and wise men in general. In verses 11 and 12, he says, "The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars or masters or teachers are like well-driven nails given by a shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these, or rather, be warned of these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh." Here is a warning. First of all, he says what wise men are. Wise men are guides for people. People want to follow a wise man. A wise man will show the way. He'll give direction. He'll provide sound advice that we can follow. That's what makes them wise. A wise man, the words of a wise man, are like goads. Goads were sticks with sharp points on the end that were used to cause the oxen to continue ploughing in the furrow and not to stop in the way. When it stopped, the plough driver would prick the heels of the oxen, the cow, with this goad and goad it on, push it on. It's a phrase that that the Lord used in speaking to the Apostle Paul, didn't he? "Saul, Saul, why are you kicking against the pricks, against the goads? Why are you like a cow who is kicking back against these sharp points? Why don't you pay attention and follow where I'm guiding you, where I'm pointing you, the direction I'm showing you?" The words of a wise man are like goads. They're like pricks that prod us in a particular direction to keep us moving. The words of scholars or masters are like well-driven nails. Their teachings are supposed to be well-founded and reliable, something that we can hang on to and not fall. These are the words of the scholars. They're given by a shepherd. A shepherd guides his flock, tends to his flock, wants the best for his flock. Well, the narrator says this is what a wise man is about. He's there to guide, to advise, to help, to direct. But he says, be warned of these. Be warned of these. Of these wise men who make many books who are continually writing down their ideas, who have lots and lots to say. Because, like the preacher, they may not have actually anything of real value to say in the end. I mean, look, all the way through this book, we've been ploughing our way through such depressing stuff that the preacher had written. The vast bulk of this book of Ecclesiastes. The words of a wise man, but not words to be followed. Not words to be taken to heart. Words on a shaky foundation. Not a well-driven nail that we can rely on to hold us up. But built on a shaky foundation. A mistaken view of the world. And so he warns. He doesn't say that all books are bad. Doesn't say that study is something to be shirked. I know it's a wonderful word for students who are trying to get off doing their homework, of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. Well, that's true. It is. But what he's saying here is it's the quality, not the quantity of the matter that is important. There are of making of books there is no end. The writer here was writing somewhere between about 400 and 900 BC. Making of many books there was no end then. Wonder what he would think of today, with new books coming out from so many thousands of publishers around the world every week. I know of one Christian publisher whose aim is to bring out a new book every week, 52 new books a year, and they're not a big publisher. Of making many books, there is no end. But is there real value in those books? Is the knowledge that they impart trustworthy? Is it worth staking our lives upon? Well, the implication, you see, of the narrator is that this preacher's words are not worth staking your life upon. His advice is not worth following, despite his 10, 11 chapters of so-called wise advice. This narrator gives out a warning. Be warned about these, he says to his son. And in contrast to the long-winded assessment of the preacher, the narrator sums it all up in two simple sentences. The preacher has been trying to find the meaning of life and has concluded that life is meaningless. The narrator, having given his summation of what he thinks of the preacher and what he thinks of worldly wise men in general, quickly moves on. Let's hear the conclusion, he says rather impatiently. Here's the meaning of life. Here's the purpose. Fear God and keep his commandments, for that is man's whole duty. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Well, the preachers talked about fearing God. The preachers talked about God's judgment. So how is this then different from what the preacher's been saying? Well, there's a number of things that make this very different from what the preacher has been saying. First of all, he connects the fear of God with the keeping of God's commandments and announces that this is man's great duty, to fear God and to keep his commandments. The preacher nowhere, not even once, urged his readers to keep the commandments of God. He told them to fear God, but as we saw as we went through, the context was always that of being terrified of God's ability to control our lives and bring pain and torment as much as good and blessing into our lives. God is someone to be afraid of. But the narrator, when he talks about fearing God, uses what is the normal meaning of this word throughout the rest of the scriptures. That is, that God is to be reverenced, that he is to be honoured. And he takes up the theme of the book of Numbers in Numbers chapter 15 and verse 39. In Numbers chapter 15, at the end of this chapter, the children of Israel have been advised to tie tassels on the corners of their garment so that they would have them as a reminder of this. He says, "You shall have the tassel that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them." They were to have tassels on their garments, so every time they looked at those tassels, saw them waving there as they walked, they would remember that they had a God to whom they owed obedience. "And that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined. And that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy for your God." That's what Numbers says. That's what the narrator says. Fear God and keep his commandments. What did the preacher say? The preacher said, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes." Numbers says that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined. The preacher is giving advice that completely contradicts the teaching of God to his people Israel. Don't follow your hearts. Don't follow your eyes. Don't fulfill the lusts of your flesh. Obey my commandments. The preacher's afraid of God because he believes that God does exist, and he believes that somehow God is a God who brings judgment. And so he advises his readers to be afraid of God, but he also advises them to do what they like. So it's a kind of a tempered fulfillment of the lusts of the flesh. But the narrator says, fear God, reverence God, give him all your respect and demonstrate it by keeping God's commandments. That is your duty. That is your purpose in life, is to honour God and obey God. As simple as that. And he goes on and says, as the preacher did, God will bring every work into judgment. The preacher said that, but as we saw, he said it with an awful lot of doubt in his mind. He looked and he saw the wicked in the world who were prospering. He looked and he saw the righteous, the good, and they seemed to be suffering. And there didn't seem to be much justice and judgment there. And in the end, all go to the grave. And that's the end of it. Because there's no proof that there's anything beyond the grave. Because, you see, the preacher won't take God literally. He's not listening to what God said. He's not reading the books of Moses and saying, well, God says I must keep his commandments, therefore I must keep his commandments. God says he will judge, therefore I must keep his commandments. God wants me to reverence him, therefore I'll do his bidding. He doesn't see it that way, you see. He just looks at the evidence in this world, and it's not sufficient to prove to him that God will bring judgment to bear in some kind of afterlife, because there's no proof that there is an afterlife. And so the preacher's foundation is like quicksand. You can't set anything on it that will last. But the narrator understands God. He's listened to God. He's not only believed that there is God, but he believes that there's a God who is active in this world to bring justice and judgment, ultimately. If not in this life, then in the life which is to come. And not only will he judge our works, the things that we do, but he will judge the secret things, the thoughts of our minds as well. God will be thorough in his judgment and bringing justice. That's this narrator's simple conclusion. The preacher at great length came to no conclusion at all, except that life was meaningless. The narrator briefly and succinctly says, life's purpose is to fear, to reverence God and obey him. And he will judge us, whether good or evil our deeds. And by implication, the good will be rewarded with things that are pleasant, and the evil will be judged and punished. Now, of course, both the preacher and the narrator lived many hundreds of years ago, hundreds of years before the New Testament was written. And we need to understand this in the light of the New Testament and not simply of the Old Testament. We can say far more than the narrator in Ecclesiastes. We have to continue in the great story of redemption, the great story of God's purpose for this world, a story that is taken up in the writings of Paul, for example, and particularly in Romans, and in Romans chapter 8. And I want to read a few verses from Romans chapter 8, because they're verses that actually reflect and harp back to the book of Ecclesiastes. Nowhere is the book of Ecclesiastes quoted in the New Testament, except here, where there seems to be a hint of Ecclesiastes in it. And I want to read to you from Romans chapter 8, verse 18 through to 27. And Paul writes to the Romans, and he says, and think all the time about the preacher in Ecclesiastes and his perspective of the world. Paul says, I consider that the suffering, sound familiar, of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, to meaninglessness, to vanity. It's exactly the same Greek word as the old scholars used to translate the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek in the what's called the Septuagint, the translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, which was quoted extensively in the New Testament. This same word is used here. For the creation was subjected to futility, to meaninglessness, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope. But hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. Likewise, the Spirit also helps us in our weakness. For we do not know what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit himself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. Now he who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. The preacher spoke about the meaninglessness of this world. And Paul takes up that theme. This creation, this world in which we live, has been subjected to meaninglessness. Not willingly, but because of the sin of mankind. The reason that our life in this world seems so futile is because of sin. The reason that there seems to be so much injustice in this world is because of sin. Sin is what has caused the preacher to be so frustrated in his quest for meaning in life. Because all he sees are the evidences of sin. And the pain and the suffering and the corruption that has brought into this world. But Paul says that's not the end of it. Because God is a redeeming God. God is a restoring God. God is a God who is going to make this world new once again. And he's going to make us new once again. And both we and creation itself yearn for that day when futility will be removed. And we will be able to fear God without the frustrations that sin brings into our life. We will be able to obey God without the stumbling blocks of sin that are strewn throughout our way. We will be able to honour and serve God and do his bidding. Because all of the corruption will have been taken away and everything will have been made new. But that hasn't come yet. That time hasn't come. It's a hope we have. Not a hope fulfilled yet. But we're so certain about it that it's almost as though it has been fulfilled. And we long for it and we earnestly desire it. But at the same time, we are confused in this life, are we not? Even we who believe in God and believe in an afterlife and believe in justice and judgment to come, even we are confused at times. Why does God allow certain things to happen? Often there is no answer. Job never received an answer to his question, why has this happened to me? God simply demonstrated that he was in control, but he never told Job why. And there are often times in our lives when we suffer and we hurt and we see suffering and we see hurt and we're confused and we don't know what's going on. And because it's all a confusion to us, we don't know what to pray. And Paul says, even then, God is at work. Even in the midst of our confusion, God is at work. His Spirit is working in us and through us. And when we don't know how to respond, and when we don't know how to ask God for things to be changed, the Holy Spirit does. And God is working out his purposes. And he will bring a new heavens and a new earth. And he calls on us to trust him, to follow him. Whether our life is full of riches and plenty and pleasure, or whether our life is full of hardship and pain and suffering, whatever our case may be, God wants us to trust him. That in the end, we'll all live happily ever after. Those who trust him, those who are seeking to walk in his ways, those who do try to fear God and keep his commandments and trust that Christ has borne the penalty for the many, many times when we fail to fear God as we ought and fail to keep his commandments as we ought. But it will all work out in the end. This isn't some vain hope. This isn't the Kiwi positive attitude, she'll be right. She will be right for those who trust God and who follow his ways. But she won't be right for the likes of the preacher in Ecclesiastes, for whom God is just a distant despot who plays with us like a cat playing with a mouse. Won't be right for a man who, though wise in many ways, fails to advise his people to keep the commandments of God, and instead suggests something to the contrary. Won't be all right for those who ignore God and go through this life fulfilling their own desires. This world is frustrating. This world at often times seems to be futile. But for those who have a hope for the future, we cling to that. It doesn't take away the pain, but it enables us to see it the way that Paul saw it. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed. The preacher had sufferings, but he could see no glory. Didn't have any conviction that there was any glory. But Paul could. And Paul could say, I have learned to be content in whatever situation I find myself, whether having plenty or whether being in need. Paul had learned the lesson of the narrator of Ecclesiastes. Fear God and keep his commandments. And for the New Testament believer, for the believer since the time of Jesus Christ, we can put it even more clearly than that. That we trust Jesus Christ, who bore our sins and purchased our redemption. And one day, this whole world, and we with it, will be made new. Well, what a positive way of looking. We needn't be depressed by what the preacher said. We can take heart from the narrator and from the Apostle Paul and from Jesus Christ and from the whole tenor of this book, which is that life, true life, quality of life, is to be found in Jesus Christ alone. Do you trust him? Will you trust him in difficult time and in good time?